small oil light that burned on the wall. I'll be all right. This was patently untrue. At the same time, it was unlikely that my presence would help particularly. Fergus could do the little that could be done. There was no known cure for seasickness, after all. One could only hope that Jared was right, and that it would ease of itself as the Artemis made its way out into the longer swells of the Atlantic. All right, I said, giving in. Perhaps you'll feel better in the morning. Jamie opened one eye for a moment, then groaned, and shivering, closed it again.
Or perhaps I'll be dead, he suggested.
On that cheery note, I made my way out into the dark companionway, only to stumble over the prostrate form of Mr. Willoughby, curled up against the door of the cabin. He grunted in surprise, then, seeing that it was only me, rolled slowly onto all fours and crawled into the cabin, swaying with the rolling of the ship. Ignoring Fergus's exclamation of distaste, he curled himself about the pedestal of the table and fell promptly back asleep, an expression of beatific content on his small, round face. My own cabin was just across the companionway, but I paused for a moment to breathe in the fresh air coming down from the deck above. There was an extraordinary variety of noises, from the creak and crack of timbers all round, to the snap of sails and the whine of rigging above, and the faint echo of a shout somewhere on deck. Despite the racket and the cold air pouring in down the companionway, Massali was sound asleep, a humped black shape in one of the two berths. Just as well. At least I needn't try to make awkward conversation with her. Despite myself, I felt a pang of sympathy for her. This was likely not what she had expected of her wedding night. It was too cold to undress. Fully clothed, I crawled into my small box berth and lay listening to the sounds of the ship around me. I could hear the hissing of the water passing the hull only a foot or two beyond my head. It was an oddly comforting sound. To the accompaniment of the song of the wind and the faint sound of retching across the corridor, I fell peacefully asleep. The Artemis was a tidy ship, as ships go. But when you cram 32 men and 2 women into a space 80 feet long and 25 wide, together with 6 tons of rough-cured hides, 42 barrels of sulphur, and enough sheets of copper and tin to sheathe the Queen Mary, basic hygiene is bound to suffer. By the second day, I had already flushed a rat. A small rat, as Fergus pointed out, but still a rat, in the hold where I went to retrieve my large medicine box, packed away there by mistake during the loading. There was a soft, shuffling noise in my cabin at night, which, when the lantern was lit, proved to be the footsteps of several dozen middling-sized cockroaches, all fleeing frantically for the shelter of the shadows. The heads, 2 small quarter galleries on either side of the ship toward the bow, were nothing more than a pair of boards, with a strategic slot between them, suspended over the bounding waves 8 feet below, so that the user was likely to get an unexpected dash of cold seawater at some highly inopportune moment. I suspected that this, coupled with a diet of salt pork and hardtack, likely caused constipation to be epidemic among seamen. Mr. Warren, the ship's master, proudly informed me that the decks were swabbed regularly every morning, the brass polished, and everything generally made shipshape, which seemed a desirable state of affairs, given that we were, in fact, aboard a ship. Still, all the holy stoning in the world couldn't disguise the fact that 34 human beings occupied this limited space, and only one of us bathed. Given such circumstances, I was more than startled when I opened the door of the galley on the second morning in search of boiling water. I had expected the same dim and grubby conditions that obtained in the cabins and holds, and was dazzled by the glitter of sunlight through the overhead lattice on a rank of copper pans so scrubbed that the metal of their bottoms shone pink. I blinked against the dazzle, my eyes adjusting, and saw that the walls of the galley were solid with built-in racks and cupboards, so constructed as to be proof against the roughest seas. blue and green glass bottles of spice, each tenderly jacketed in felt against injury, vibrated softly in their rack above the pots. Knives, cleavers and skewers gleamed in deadly array, in a quantity sufficient to deal with a whale carcass, should one present itself. A rimmed double shelf hung from the bulkhead, thick with bulb glasses and shallow plates, on which a quantity of fresh-cut turnip tops was set to sprout for greens. An enormous pot bubbled softly over the stove, emitting a fragrant steam. And in the midst of all this spotless splendour stood the cook, surveying me with a baleful eye.
"Out," he said.
"Good morning," I said, as cordially as possible. "My name is Claire Fraser."
"Out,"
he repeated in the same gravelled tones. "I am Mrs. Fraser, wife of the supercargo, and ship's surgeon for this voyage," I said, giving him eyeball for eyeball. "I require 6 gallons of boiling water, when convenient, for cleaning of the head." His small, bright blue eyes grew somewhat smaller and brighter, the black pupils of them training on me like gun barrels.
"I am Aloysius O'Shaughnessy Murphy," he said, "ship's cook. And I require you to take your feet off my fresh-washed deck. I do not allow women in my galley."
He glowered at me under the edge of the black cotton kerchief that swathed his head. He was several inches shorter than I, but made up for it by measuring about 3 feet more in circumference, with a restless shoulders and a head like a cannonball, set upon them without apparent benefit of an intervening neck. A wooden leg completed the ensemble. I took one step back, with dignity, and spoke to him from the relative safety of the passageway. "In that case," I said, "you may send up the hot water by the mess boy."
"I may," he agreed. "And then again, I may not."
He turned his broad back on me in dismissal, busying himself with a chopping block, a cleaver, and a joint of mutton. I stood in the passageway for a moment, thinking. The thud of the cleaver sounded regularly against the wood. Mr. Murphy reached up to his spice rack, grasped a bottle without looking, and sprinkled a good quantity of the contents over the diced meat. The dusty scent of sage filled the air, superseded at once by the pungency of an onion whacked in two with a casual swipe of the cleaver and tossed into the mixture. Evidently the crew of the Artemis didn't subsist entirely upon salt pork and hardtack, then. I began to understand the reasons for Captain Raines's rather pear-shaped physique. I poked my head back through the door, taking care to stand outside. "Cardamom," I said firmly. "Nutmeg, whole, dried this year. Fresh extract of anise. Ginger root, 2 large ones with no blemishes." I paused. Mr. Murphy had stopped chopping, cleaver poised motionless above the block. "And," I added, "half a dozen whole vanilla beans from Ceylon." He turned slowly, wiping his hands upon his leather apron. Unlike his surroundings, neither the apron nor his other apparel was spotless. He had a broad, florid face edged with stiff, sandy whiskers like a scrubbing brush, which quivered slightly as he looked at me, like the antennae of some large insect. His tongue darted out to lick pursed lips.
"Saffron?" he asked hoarsely.
"Half an ounce," I said promptly, taking care to conceal any trace of triumph in my manner. He breathed in deeply, lust gleaming bright in his small blue eyes.
"You'll find a mat just outside, ma'am, should you care to wipe your boots and come in."
One head sterilized within the limits of boiling water and Fergus's tolerance, I made my way back to my cabin to clean up for luncheon. Massali was not there. She was undoubtedly attending to Fergus, whose labours at my insistence had been little short of heroic. I rinsed my own hands with alcohol, brushed my hair, and then went across the passage to see whether, by some wild chance, Jamie wanted anything to eat or drink. One glance disabused me of this notion. Massali and I had been given the largest cabin, which meant that each of us had approximately 6 square feet of space, not including the beds. These were box berths, a sort of enclosed bed built into the wall about 5.5 feet long. Massali fitted neatly into hers, but I was forced to adopt a slightly curled position, like a caper on toast, which caused me to wake up with pins and needles in my feet. Jamie and Fergus had similar berths. Jamie was lying on his side, wedged into one of these like a snail into its shell, one of which beasts he strongly resembled at the moment, being a pale and viscid grey in colour, with streaks of green and yellow that contrasted nastily with his red hair. He opened one eye when he heard me come in, regarded me dimly for a moment, and closed it again. "Not so good, hmm?" I said sympathetically. The eye opened again, and he seemed to be preparing to say something. He opened his mouth, changed his mind, and closed it again.
"No,"
he said, and shut the eye once more. I tentatively smoothed his hair, but he seemed too sunk in misery to notice. "Captain Rain says it will likely be calmer by tomorrow," I offered. The sea wasn't terribly rough as it was, but there was a noticeable rise and fall.
"That doesn't matter," he said, not opening his eyes. "I shall be dead by then, or at least I hope so."
"Afraid not," I said, shaking my head. "Nobody dies of seasickness, though I must say it seems a wonder that they don't, looking at you."
"Not that."
He opened his eyes and struggled up on one elbow, an effort that left him clammy with sweat and white to the lips.
"Claire, be careful. I should have told you before, but I didn't want to worry, and I thought..."
His face changed. Familiar as I was with expressions of bodily infirmity, I had the basin there just in time.
"Oh, God."
He lay limp and exhausted, pale as the sheet. "What should you have told me?" I asked, wrinkling my nose as I put the basin on the floor near the door. "Whatever it was, you should have told me before we sailed. But it's too late to think of that."
"I didn't think it would be so bad,"
he murmured. "You never do," I said rather tartly. "What did you want to tell me, though?"
"Ask Fergus," he said. "Say I said he must tell you. And tell him Ennis is all right."
"What are you talking about?" I was mildly alarmed. Delirium wasn't a common effect of seasickness. His eyes opened and fixed on mine with great effort. Beads of sweat stood out on his brow and upper lip.
"Ennis," he said, "he canna be the one. He doesna mean to kill me."
A small shiver ran up my spine. "Are you quite all right, Jamie?" I asked. I bent and wiped his face, and he gave me the ghost of an exhausted smile. He had no fever, and his eyes were clear. "Who?" I said carefully, with a sudden feeling that there were eyes fixed on my back. "Who does mean to kill you?"
"I don't know."
A passing spasm contorted his features, but he clamped his lips tight and managed to subdue it.
"Ask Fergus," he whispered when he could talk again. "In private. He'll tell you."
I felt exceedingly helpless. I had no notion what he was talking about, but if there was any danger, I wasn't about to leave him alone. "I'll wait till he comes down," I said. One hand was curled near his nose. It straightened slowly and slid under the pillow, coming out with his dirk, which he clasped to his chest.
"I shall be all right," he said. "Go on then, Sassenach. I shouldn't think they'd try anything in daylight, if at all."
I didn't find this reassuring in the slightest, but there seemed nothing else to do. He lay quite still, the dirk held to his chest like a stone tomb figure.
"Go,"
he murmured again, his lips barely moving. Just outside the cabin door, something stirred in the shadows at the end of the passage. Peering sharply, I made out the crouched silk shape of Mr. Willoughby, chin resting on his knees. He spread his knees apart and bowed his head politely between them.
"Not worry, Honourable First Wife," he assured me in a sibilant whisper. "I watch."
"Good," I said. "Keep doing it." And went, in considerable distress of mind, to find Fergus. Fergus, found with Massali on the afterdeck, peering into the ship's wake at several large white birds, was somewhat more reassuring.
"We are not sure that anyone intends actually to kill Milor," he explained. "The casks in the warehouse might have been an accident. I have seen such things happen more than once. And likewise the fire in the shed, but..."
"Wait 1 minute, young Fergus," I said, gripping him by the sleeve. "What casks and what fire?"
"Oh," he said, looking surprised. "Milor did not tell you."
"Milor is sick as a dog and incapable of telling me anything more than that I should ask you." Fergus shook his head, clicking his tongue in a censorious French way.
"He never thinks he will be so ill," he said. "He always is. And yet every time he must set foot on a ship, he insists that it is only a matter of will. His mind will be master, and he will not allow his stomach to be dictating his actions. Then, within 10 feet of the dock, he has turned green."
"He never told me that," I said, amused at this description.
"Stubborn little fool."
Massali had been hanging back behind Fergus with an air of haughty reserve, pretending that I wasn't there. At this unexpected description of Jamie, though, she was surprised into a brief snort of laughter. She caught my eye and turned hastily away, cheeks flaming, to stare out to sea. Fergus smiled and shrugged.
"You know what he is like, milady,"
he said with tolerant affection.
"He could be dying, and one would never know."
"You'd know if you went down and looked at him now," I said tartly. At the same time, I was conscious of surprise, accompanied by a faint feeling of warmth in the pit of my stomach. Fergus had been with Jamie almost daily for 20 years, and still Jamie would not admit to him the weakness that he would readily let me see. Were he dying, I would know about it, all right.
"Men," I said, shaking my head. "Milady?"
"Never mind," I said. "You were telling me about casks and fires."
"Oh, indeed, yes."
Fergus brushed back his thick shock of black hair with his hook.
"It was the day before I met you again, milady, at Madame Jean's."
The day I had returned to Edinburgh, no more than a few hours before I had found Jamie at the print shop. He had been at the Burnt Island docks with Fergus and a gang of 6 men during the night, taking advantage of the late dawn of winter to retrieve several casks of unbonded Madeira smuggled in among a shipment of innocent flour.
"Madeira does not soak through the wood so quickly as some other wines do," Fergus explained. "You cannot bring in brandy under the noses of the customs like that, for the dogs will smell it at once, even if their masters do not. But not Madeira, provided it has been freshly casked."
"Dogs?"
"Some of the customs inspectors have dogs, milady, trained to smell out such contraband as tobacco and brandy."
He waved away the interruption, squinting his eyes against the brisk sea wind.
"We had removed the Madeira safely and brought it to the warehouse, one of those belonging apparently to Lord Dundas, but in fact it belongs jointly to Milor and Madame Jeanne."
"Indeed," I said again, with that minor dip of the stomach I had felt when Jamie opened the door of the brothel on Queen Street. "Partners, are they?"
"Well, of a sort."
Fergus sounded regretful.
"Milor has only a 5% share in return for his finding the place and making the arrangements. Printing as an occupation is much less profitable than keeping a hôtel de joie."
Massali didn't look round, but I thought her shoulders stiffened further.
"I dare say," I said.
"Edinburgh and Madame Jeanne were a long way behind us, after all. Get on with the story. Someone may cut Jamie's throat before I find out why."
"Of course, milady."
Fergus bobbed his head apologetically. The contraband had been safely hidden, awaiting disguise and sale, and the smugglers had paused to refresh themselves with a drink in lieu of breakfast before making their way home in the brightening dawn. 2 of the men had asked for their shares at once, needing the money to pay gaming debts and buy food for their families. Jamie, agreeing to this, had gone across to the warehouse office where some gold was kept. As the men relaxed over their whiskey in a corner of the warehouse, their joking and laughter was interrupted by a sudden vibration that shook the floor beneath their feet. "Come down!" shouted MacLeod, an experienced warehouseman, and the men had dived for cover even before they had seen the great rack of hogsheads near the office quiver and rumble, one 2-ton cask rolling down the stack with ponderous grace to smash in an aromatic lake of ale, followed within seconds by a cascade of its monstrous fellows.
"Milor was crossing in front of the rank," Fergus said, shaking his head. "It was only by the grace of the Blessed Virgin herself that he was not crushed."
A bounding cask had missed him by inches, in fact, and he had escaped another only by diving headfirst out of its way and under an empty wine rack that had deflected its course.
"As I say, such things happen often," Fergus said, shrugging. "A dozen men are killed each year in accidents in the warehouses near Edinburgh alone. But with the other things..."
The week before the incident of the casks, a small shed full of packing straw had burst into flames while Jamie was working in it. A lantern placed between him and the door had apparently fallen over, setting the straw alight and trapping Jamie in the windowless shed behind a sudden wall of flame.
"The shed was fortunately of a most flimsy construction, and the boards half rotted. It went up like matchwood, but Milor was able to kick a hole in the back wall and crawl out with no injury. We thought at first that the lantern had merely fallen of its own accord, and were most grateful for his escape. It was only later that Milor told me he thought that he had heard a noise, perhaps a shot, perhaps only the cracking noises an old warehouse makes as its boards settle. And when he turned to see, found the flames shooting up before him."
Fergus sighed. He looked rather tired, and I wondered whether perhaps he had stayed awake to stand watch over Jamie during the night.
"So," he said, shrugging once more, "we do not know. Such incidents may have been no more than accident. They may not. But taking such occurrences together with what happened at Arbroath..."
"You may have a traitor among the smugglers," I said.
"Just so, milady."
Fergus scratched his head.
"But what is more disturbing to Milor is the man whom the Chinaman shot at Madame Jeanne's."
"Because you think he was a customs agent who tracked Jamie from the docks to the brothel?"
"Jamie said he couldn't be because he had no warrant." "Not proof," Fergus noted, "but worse, the booklet he had in his pocket."
"The New Testament?" "I saw no particular relevance to that and said so."
"Oh, but there is, milady. Or might be, I should say."
Fergus corrected himself.
"You see, the booklet was one that Milor himself had printed."
"I see," I said slowly. "Or at least I'm beginning to." Fergus nodded gravely.
"To have the customs trace brandy from the points of delivery to the brothel would be bad, of course, but not fatal. Another hiding place could be found. In fact, Milor has arrangements with the owners of 2 taverns that... But that is of no matter."
He waved it away.
"But to have the agents of the Crown connect the notorious smuggler Jamie Roy with the respectable Mr. Malcolm of Carfax Close..."
He spread his hands wide.
"You see?"
I did. Were the customs to get too close to his smuggling operations, Jamie could merely disperse his assistants, cease frequenting his smuggler's haunts, and disappear for a time, retreating into his guise as a printer until it seemed safe to resume his illegal activities. But to have his 2 identities both detected and merged was not only to deprive him of both his sources of income, but to arouse such suspicion as may lead to discovery of his real name, his seditious activities, and thence to Lallybroch, and to his history as rebel and convicted traitor. They would have evidence to hang him 12 times, and once was enough.
"I certainly do see."
So Jamie wasn't only worried about Lyra and Hobart Mackenzie when he told Ian he thought it would be as well for us to skip to France for a bit. Paradoxically, I felt somewhat relieved by Fergus's revelations. At least I hadn't been single-handedly responsible for Jamie's exile. My reappearance might have precipitated the crisis with Lyra, but I had had nothing to do with any of this.
Exactly, milady. And still, we do not know for certain that one of the men has betrayed us, or whether, even if there should be a traitor among them, he should wish to kill Milor.
That's a point. It was, but not a large one. If one of the smugglers had undertaken to betray Jamie for money, that was one thing. If it was for some motive of personal vengeance, though, the man might well feel compelled to take matters into his own hands, now that we were, temporarily at least, out of reach of the king's customs.
If so, Fergus was continuing, it will be one of six men, the six Milor sent me to collect, to sail with us. These six were present both when the casks fell and when the shed caught fire. All have been to the brothel.
He paused.
And all of them were present on the road at Arbroath when we were ambushed and found the excisemen hanged.
Do they all know about the print shop?
Oh, no, milady. Milor has always been most careful to let none of the smuggling men know of that. But it is always possible that one of them shall have seen him on the streets in Edinburgh, followed him to Carfax Close, and so learned of A. Malcolm.
He smiled wryly.
Milor is not the most inconspicuous of men, milady.
Very true, I said, matching his tone. But now all of them know Jamie's real name. Captain Rains calls him Fraser.
Yes, he said, with a faint grim smile. That is why we must discover whether we do indeed sail with a traitor, and who it is.
Looking at him, it occurred to me for the first time that Fergus was indeed a grown man now, and a dangerous one. I had known him as an eager, squirrel-toothed boy of 10, and to me something of that boy would always remain in his face. But some time had passed since he had been a Paris street urchin. Massali had remained staring out to sea during most of this discussion, preferring to take no risk of having to converse with me. She had obviously been listening, though, and now I saw a shiver pass through her thin shoulders, whether of cold or apprehension, I couldn't tell. She likely hadn't planned on shipping with a potential murderer when she had agreed to elope with Fergus. "You'd better take Massali below," I said to Fergus. "She's going blue round the edges." "Don't worry," I said to Massali in a cool voice. "I shan't be in the cabin for some time."
"Where are you going, milady?"
Fergus was squinting at me, slightly suspicious.
"Milor will not wish you to be—"
"I don't mean to," I assured him. "I'm going to the galley."
"The galley?"
His fine black brow shot up. "To see whether Aloysius O'Shaughnessy Murphy has anything to suggest for seasickness," I said. "If we don't get Jamie back on his feet, he isn't going to care whether anyone cuts his throat or not." Murphy, sweetened by an ounce of dried orange peel and a bottle of Jared's best claret, was quite willing to oblige. In fact, he seemed to consider the problem of keeping food in Jamie's stomach something of a professional challenge, and spent hours in mystic contemplation of his spice rack and pantries, all to no avail. We encountered no storms, but the winter winds drove a heavy swell before them, and the Artemis rose and fell 10 feet at a time, labouring up and down the great glassy peaks of the waves. There were times, watching the hypnotic rise and lurch of the taffrail against the horizon, when I felt a few interior qualms of my own, and turned hastily away. Jamie showed no signs of being about to fulfil Jared's heartening prophecy and spring to his feet, suddenly accustomed to the motion. He remained in his berth, the colour of rancid custard, moving only to stagger to the head and guarded in turns day and night by Mr. Willoughby and Fergus. On the positive side of things, none of the six smugglers made any move that might be considered threatening. All expressed a sympathetic concern for Jamie's welfare, and, carefully watched, all had visited him briefly in his cabin with no suspicious circumstances attending. For my part, I spent the days in exploring the ship, attending to such small medical emergencies as arose from the daily business of sailing. A smashed finger, a cracked rib, bleeding gums, and an abscessed tooth, and pounding herbs and making medicines in a corner of the galley, allowed to work there by Murphy's grace. Massali was absent from our shared cabin when I rose, already asleep when I returned to it, and silently hostile when the cramped confines of shipboard forced us to meet on deck or over meals. I assumed that the hostility was in part the result of her natural feelings for her mother, and in part the result of frustration over passing her night hours in my company rather than Fergus's. For that matter, if she remained untouched, and judging from her sullen demeanour I was reasonably sure she did, it was owing entirely to Fergus's respect for Jamie's dictates. In terms of his role as guardian of his stepdaughter's virtue, Jamie himself was a negligible force at the moment.
"What? Not the broth, too?" Murphy said.
The cook's broad red face lowered menacingly.
"Which I've had folk rise from their deathbeds after a sup of that broth."
He took a pannikin of broth from Fergus, sniffed at it critically, and thrust it under my nose.
"Here, smell that, missus. Marrow bones, garlic, caraway seed, and a lump of pork fat to flavour. All strained careful through muslin, same as some folks being poorly to their stomachs can't abide chunks. But chunks you'll not find there, not a one."
The broth was, in fact, a clear golden brown with an appetising smell that made my own mouth water, despite the excellent breakfast I had made less than an hour before. Captain Rains had a delicate stomach, and, in consequence, had taken some pains both in the procurement of a cook and the provisioning of the galley to the benefit of the officers' table. Murphy, with a wooden leg and the general dimensions of a rum cask, looked the picture of a thoroughgoing pirate, but, in fact, had a reputation as the best sea cook in Le Havre, as he had told me himself without the least boastfulness. He considered cases of seasickness a challenge to his skill, and Jamie, still prostrate after 4 days, was a particular affront to him. "I'm sure it's wonderful broth," I assured him. "It's just that he can't keep anything down." Murphy grunted dubiously, but turned and carefully poured the remains of the broth into one of the numerous kettles that steamed day and night over the galley fire. Scowling horribly, and running one hand through the wisps of his scanty blonde hair, he opened a cupboard and closed it, then bent to rummage through a chest of provisions, muttering under his breath.
"A bit of hard tack, maybe," he muttered. "Dry, that's what's wanted. Maybe a whiff of vinegar, though. Tart pickle, say."
I watched in fascination as the cook's huge sausage-fingered hands flicked deftly through the stock of provisions, plucking dainties and assembling them swiftly on a tray.
"Here, let's try this, then," he said, handing me the finished tray. "Let him suck on the pickled gherkin, but don't let him bite him yet. Then follow on with a bite of the plain hard tack. There ain't no weevils in it yet, I don't think. But see as he don't drink water with it. Then a bite of gherkin, well chewed, to make the spittle flow. A bite of hard tack, and so to go on with. That much staying down, then, we can proceed to the custard, which it's fresh made last evening for the captain's supper. Then, if that sticks..."
His voice followed me out of the galley, continuing the catalogue of available nourishment.
"Milk toast, which is made with goat's milk, and fresh milk too. Syllabub, beat up well with whisky, and a nice egg," boomed down the passageway as I negotiated the narrow turn with the loaded tray, carefully stepping over Mr. Willoughby, who was, as usual, crouched in a corner of the passage by Jamie's door like a small blue lapdog. One step inside the cabin, though,
I could see that the exercise of Murphy's culinary skill was going to be once again in vain. In the usual fashion of a man feeling unwell, Jamie had managed to arrange his surroundings to be as depressing and uncomfortable as possible. The tiny cabin was dank and squalid, the cramped berth covered with a cloth so as to exclude both light and air, and half-piled with a tangle of clammy blankets and unwashed clothes. "Rise and shine," I said cheerfully. I set down the tray and pulled off the makeshift curtain, which appeared to be one of Fergus's shirts. What light there was came from a large prism embedded in the deck overhead. It struck the berth, illuminating a countenance of ghastly pallor and baleful mien. He opened one eye, an eighth of an inch.
"Go away," he said, and shut it again.
"I've brought you some breakfast," I said firmly. The eye opened again, coldly blue and gelid.
"Dinna mention the word breakfast to me," he said.
"Call it luncheon, then," I said. "It's late enough." I pulled up a stool next to him, picked a gherkin from the tray, and held it invitingly under his nose. "You're supposed to suck on it," I told him. Slowly the other eye opened. He said nothing, but the pair of blue orbs swiveled around, resting on me with an expression of such ferocious eloquence that I hastily withdrew the pickle. The eyelids drooped slowly shut once more. I surveyed the wreckage, frowning. He lay on his back, his knees drawn up. While the built-in berth provided more stability for the sleeper than the crew's swinging hammocks, it was designed to accommodate the usual run of passengers who, judging from the size of the berth, were assumed to be no more than a modest 5'3" or so. "You can't be all that comfortable in there," I said.
"I am not."
"Would you like to try a hammock instead? At least you could stretch."
"I would not."
"The captain says he requires a list of the cargo from you, at your convenience." He made a brief and unrepeatable suggestion as to what Captain Raines might do with his list, not bothering to open his eyes. I sighed and picked up his unresisting hand. It was cold and damp, and his pulse was fast. "Well," I said, after a pause, "perhaps we could try something I used to do with surgical patients. It seemed to help sometimes." He gave a low groan, but didn't object. I pulled up a stool and sat down, still holding his hand. I had developed the habit of talking with the patients for a few minutes before they were taken to surgery. My presence seemed to reassure them, and I had found that if I could fix their attention on something beyond the impending ordeal, they seemed to do better. There was less bleeding, the post-anaesthetic nausea was less, and they seemed to heal better. I had seen it happen often enough to believe that it wasn't imagination. Jamie hadn't been altogether wrong when assuring Fergus that the power of mind over flesh was possible. "Let's think of something pleasant," I said, pitching my voice to be as low and soothing as possible. "Think of Lallybroch, of the hillside above the house. Think of the pine trees there. Can you smell the needles? Think of the smoke coming up from the kitchen chimney on a clear day, and an apple in your hand. Think about how it feels in your hand, all hard and smooth, and then..."
"Sassenach."
Both Jamie's eyes were open and fixed on me in intense concentration. Sweat gleamed in the hollow of his temples. "Yes?"
"Go away."
"What?"
"Go away,"
he repeated very gently,
"or I shall break your neck. Go away now."
I rose with dignity and went out.
This ends Disc 22. Voyager, Disc 23.
Mr. Willoughby was leaning against an upright in the passage, peering thoughtfully into the cabin. "Don't have those stone balls with you, do you?" I asked.
"Yes," he answered, looking surprised. "Wanting healthy balls for Tsai Mi?"
He began to fumble in his sleeve, but I stopped him with a gesture.
"What I want to do is bash him on the head with them.
But I suppose Hippocrates would frown on that." Mr. Willoughby smiled uncertainly and bobbed his head several times in an effort to express appreciation of whatever I thought I meant.
"Never mind," I said.
I glared back over my shoulder at the heap of reeking bedclothes. It stirred slightly, and a groping hand emerged, patting gingerly around the floor until it found the basin that stood there. Grasping this, the hand disappeared into the murky depths of the berth, from which presently emerged the sound of dry retching.
"Bloody man," I said,
exasperation mingled with pity, and a slight feeling of alarm. The 10 hours of a channel crossing were one thing. What would his state be like after 2 months of this?
"Head of pig," Mr. Willoughby agreed with a lugubrious nod. "He is rat, you think, or maybe dragon." "He smells like a whole zoo," I said.
"Why dragon, though?"
"One is born in year of dragon, year of rat, year of sheep, year of horse," Mr. Willoughby explained. "Being different, each year, different people. You are knowing it's Saimi rat or dragon."
"You mean, which year was he born in?" I had vague memories of the menus in Chinese restaurants decorated with the animals of the Chinese zodiac with explanations of the supposed character traits of those born in each year.
"It was 1721, but I don't know offhand which animal that was the year of." "I am thinking rat," said Mr. Willoughby, looking thoughtfully at the tangle of bedclothes, which were heaving in a mildly agitated manner. "Rat, very clever, very lucky. But dragon too could be. He is most lusty in bed, Saimi. Dragon's most passionate people."
"Not so as you would notice lately," I said, watching the heap of bedclothes out of the corner of my eye. It heaved upward and fell back, as though the contents had turned over suddenly.
"I have Chinese medicine," Mr. Willoughby said, observing this phenomenon thoughtfully. "Good for vomit, stomach, head. All making most peaceful and serene."
I looked at him with interest. "Really? I'd like to see that. Have you tried it on Jamie yet?" The little Chinese shook his head regretfully.
"Not want," he replied. "Say damn all, throwing overboard if I am come near."
Mr. Willoughby and I looked at each other with a perfect understanding. "You know," I said, raising my voice a decibel or two, "prolonged dry retching is very bad for a person."
"Oh, most bad, yes."
Mr. Willoughby had shaved the forward part of his skull that morning. The bald curve shone as he nodded vigorously.
"It erodes the stomach tissues and irritates the esophagus." "This is so?"
"Quite so. It raises the blood pressure and strains the abdominal muscles too. Can even tear them and cause a hernia."
"Ah."
"And," I continued, raising my voice just a trifle, "it can cause the testicles to become tangled round each other inside the scrotum and cuts off the circulation there."
"Ooh."
Mr. Willoughby's eyes went round.
"If that happens," I said ominously, "the only thing to do, usually, is to amputate before gangrene sets in."
Mr. Willoughby made a hissing sound indicative of understanding and deep shock. The heap of bedclothes, which had been tossing to and fro in a restless manner during this conversation, was quite still. I looked at Mr. Willoughby. He shrugged. I folded my arms and waited. After a minute, a long foot, elegantly bare, was extruded from the bedclothes. A moment later, its fellow joined it, resting on the floor.
"Damn the pair of you," said a deep Scottish voice in tones of extreme malevolence. "Come in, then."
Fergus and Missali were leaning over the aft rail, cosily shoulder to shoulder, Fergus's arm about the girl's waist, her long fair hair fluttering in the wind. Hearing approaching footsteps, Fergus glanced back over his shoulder. Then he gasped, whirled round and crossed himself, eyes bulging.
"Not one word, if you please," Jamie said between clenched teeth.
Fergus opened his mouth, but nothing came out. Missali, turning to look too, emitted a shrill scream. "Da, what's happened to you?" The obvious fright and concern in her face stopped Jamie from whatever acerbic remark he'd been about to make. His face relaxed slightly, making the slender gold needles that protruded from behind his ears twitch like ants' feelers.
"That's all right," he said gruffly. "It's only some rubbish of the Chinese to cure the puking."
Wide-eyed, Missali came up to him, gingerly extending a finger to touch the needles embedded in the flesh of his wrist below the palm. Three more flashed from the inside of his leg, a few inches above the ankle.
Does it work?" she asked.
"How does it feel?" Jamie's mouth twitched, his normal sense of humour beginning to reassert itself.
"I feel like a bloody ill-wished doll that someone's been poking full of pins," he said. "But then I haven't vomited in the last quarter hour, so I suppose it must work."
He shot a quick glare at me and Mr. Willoughby, standing side by side near the rail.
"Mind you," he said, "I don't feel like sucking on gherkins just yet, but I could maybe go so far as to relish a glass of ale, if you mind where some might be found, Fergus."
Oh, yes, my lord, if you will come with me."
Unable to refrain from staring, Fergus reached out a tentative hand to take Jamie's arm, but, thinking better of it, turned in the direction of the after gangway. "Shall I tell Murphy to start cooking a luncheon?" I called after Jamie as he turned to follow Fergus. He gave me a long, level look over one shoulder. The golden needles sprouted through his hair in twin bunches, gleaming in the morning light like a pair of devil's horns.
"Dinna try me too high, Sassenach," he said. "I'm no going to forget you, Ken. Tangled testicles. Pah!"
Mr. Willoughby had been ignoring this exchange, squatting on his heels in the shadow of the aft-deck scuttlebutt, a large barrel filled with water for refreshment of the deck watch. He was counting on his fingers, evidently absorbed in some kind of calculation. As Jamie stalked away, he looked up.
"Not rat," he said, shaking his head. "Not dragon, too. Tsemi, born in year of ox."
"Really?" I said, looking after the broad shoulders and red head lowered stubbornly against the wind. "How appropriate." Chapter 42. The Man in the Moon. As his title suggested, Jamie's job as supercargo was not onerous. Beyond checking the contents of the hold against the bills of lading to ensure that the Artemis was in fact carrying the requisite quantities of hides, tin and sulphur, there was nothing for him to do while at sea. His duties would begin once we reached Jamaica, when the cargo must be unloaded, rechecked and sold, with the requisite taxes paid, commissions deducted and paperwork filed. In the meantime, there was little for him or me to do. While Mr. Pickard, the boatswain, eyed Jamie's powerful frame covetously, it was obvious that he would never make a seaman. Quick and agile as any of the crew, his ignorance of ropes and sails made him useless for anything beyond the occasional situation where sheer strength was required. It was plain he was a soldier, not a sailor. He did assist with enthusiasm at the gunnery practice that was held every other day, helping to run the four huge guns on their carriages in and out with a tremendous racket, and spending hours in rapt discussion of esoteric cannon lore with Tom Sturgis, the gunner. During these thunderous exercises, Missali, Mr. Willoughby and I sat safely out of the way under the care of Fergus, who was excluded from the fireworks because of his missing hand. Somewhat to my surprise, I had been accepted as the ship's surgeon with little question from the crew. It was Fergus who explained that in small merchant ships, even barber surgeons were uncommon. It was commonly the gunner's wife, if he had one, who dealt with the small injuries and illnesses of the crew. I saw the normal run of crushed fingers, burnt hands, skin infections, abscessed teeth and digestive ills. But in a crew of only 32 men, there was seldom enough work to keep me busy beyond the hour of sick call each morning. In consequence, both Jamie and I had a great deal of free time. And as the Artemis grew gradually south into the great gyre of the Atlantic, we began to spend most of this time with each other. For the first time since my return to Edinburgh, there was time to talk, to relearn all the half-forgotten things we knew of each other, to find out the new facets that experience had polished, and simply to take pleasure in each other's presence without the distractions of danger and daily life. We strolled the deck constantly, up and down, marking off miles as we conversed of everything and nothing, pointing out to each other the phenomena of a sea voyage, the spectacular sunrises and sunsets, schools of strange green and silver fish, enormous islands of floating seaweed harbouring thousands of tiny crabs and jellyfish, the sleek dolphins that appeared for several days in a row, swimming parallel with the ship, leaping out of the water now and then, as though to get a look at the curious creatures above the water. The moon rose huge and fast and golden, a great glowing disk that slid upward out of the water and into the sky like a phoenix rising. The water was dark now, and the dolphins invisible, but I thought somehow that they were still there, keeping pace with the ship on her flight through the dark. It was a scene breathtaking enough even for the sailors who had seen it 1,000 times to stop and sigh with pleasure at the sight as the huge orb rose to hang just over the edge of the world, seeming almost near enough to touch. Jamie and I stood close together by the rail, admiring it. It seemed so close that we could make out with ease the dark spots and shadows on its surface.
"It seems so close you could speak to the man in the moon," he said, smiling,
and waved a hand in greeting to the dreaming golden face above. "The weeping Pleiad's wester, and the moon is under seas," I quoted. "And look, it is, down there, too." I pointed over the rail to where the trail of moonlight deepened, glowing in the water as though a twin of the moon itself was sunken there. "When I left," I said, "men were getting ready to fly to the moon. I wonder whether they'll make it."
"Do the flying machines go so high, then?" Jamie asked.
He squinted at the moon.
"I should say it's a great way, for all it looks so close just now. I read a book by an astronomer. He said it was perhaps 300 leagues from the Earth to the moon. Is he wrong, then? Or is it only that the airplanes, was it, will fly so far?"
"It takes a special kind called a rocket," I said. "Actually, it's a lot farther than that to the moon. And once you get far away from the Earth, there's no air to breathe in space. They have to carry air with them on the voyage, like food and water. They put it in sort of canisters."
"Really?"
He gazed up, face full of light and wonder.
"What will it look like there, I wonder?"
"I know that," I said. "I've seen pictures. It's rocky and barren, with no life at all, but very beautiful, with cliffs and mountains and craters. You can see the craters from here, the dark spots." I nodded toward the smiling moon, then smiled at Jamie myself. "It's not unlike Scotland, except that it isn't green." He laughed. Then, evidently reminded by the word pictures, reached into his coat and drew out the little packet of photographs. He was cautious about them, never taking them out where they might be seen by anyone, even Fergus. But we were alone back here, with little chance of interruption. The moon was bright enough to see Brianna's face, glowing and mutable as he thumbed slowly through the pictures. The edges were becoming frayed, I saw.
"Will she walk about on the moon, do you think?"
he asked softly, pausing at a shot of Brie, looking out a window, secretly dreaming, unaware of being photographed. He glanced up again at the orb above us, and I realised that for him, a voyage to the moon seemed very little more difficult or far-fetched than the one in which we were engaged. The moon, after all, was only another distant, unknown place. "I don't know," I said, smiling a bit. He thumbed through the pictures slowly, absorbed as he always was by the sight of his daughter's face, so like his own. I watched him quietly, sharing his silent joy at this promise of our immortality. I thought briefly of that stone in Scotland, engraved with his name, and took comfort from its distance. Whenever our parting might come, chances were it wouldn't be soon. And even when and where it did, Brianna would still be left of us. More of Houseman's lines drifted through my head. Halt by the headstone naming, the heart no longer stirred, and say the lad that loved you was one that kept his word. I drew close to him, feeling the heat of his body through coat and shirt, and rested my head against his arm as he turned slowly through the small stack of photographs. "She is beautiful," he murmured, as he did every time he saw the pictures. "And clever too, did you not see?" "Just like her father," I told him, and felt him chuckle softly. I felt him stiffen slightly as he turned one picture over and lifted my head to see which one he was looking at. It was one taken at the beach when Brianna was about 16. It showed her standing thigh-deep in the surf, hair in a sandy tangle, kicking water at her friend, a boy named Rodney, who was backing away, laughing too, hands held up against the spray of water. Jamie frowned slightly, lips pursed.
"That," he began. "Do they?"
He paused and cleared his throat.
"I wouldna venture to criticise Claire,"
he said very carefully.
"But do you not think this is a wee bit indecent?"
I suppressed an urge to laugh. "No," I said composedly. "That's really quite a modest bathing suit, for the time." While the suit in question was a bikini, it was by no means skimpy, rising to at least an inch below Bree's navel. "I chose this picture because I thought you'd want to see as much of her as possible." He looked mildly scandalised at this thought, but his eyes returned to the picture, drawn irresistibly. His face softened as he looked at her.
"Aye, well," he said. "Aye, she's very lovely, and I'm glad to know it."
He lifted the picture, studying it carefully.
"No, it's no the thing she's wearing, I meant. Most women who bathe outside do it naked, and their skins are no shame to them. It's only this lad. Surely she shouldn't be standing almost naked before a man."
He scowled at the hapless Rodney, and I bit my lip at the thought of the scrawny little boy, whom I knew very well, as a masculine threat to maidenly purity. "Well," I said, drawing a deep breath, "we were on slightly delicate ground here. No, I mean, boys and girls do play together, like that. You know people dress differently then, I've told you. No one's really covered up a great deal, except when the weather's cold."
"Mm-hmm," he said. "Aye, you've told me."
He managed to convey the distinct impression that on the basis of what I'd told him, he was not impressed with the moral conditions under which his daughter was living. He scowled at the picture again, and I thought it was fortunate that neither Bree nor Rodney was present. I had seen Jamie as lover, husband, brother, uncle, laird, and warrior, but never before in his guise as a ferocious Scottish father. He was quite formidable. For the first time, I thought that perhaps it wasn't altogether a bad thing that he wasn't able to oversee Bree's life personally. He would have frightened the living daylights out of any lad bold enough to try to court her. Jamie blinked at the picture once or twice, then took a deep breath, and I could feel him brace himself to ask, Do you think she's a virgin? The halt in his voice was barely perceptible, but I caught it. Of course she is, I said firmly. I thought it very likely, in fact, but this wasn't a situation in which to admit the possibility of doubt. There were things I could explain.